Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session, pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you, be seated. The orders of the...
Well, they're coming up tomorrow.
There are no orders of the court as yet for this week. Two clauses will be submitted for oral argument this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. George A. Fuller Company of Texas Incorporated versus Carpet Services Incorporated from Dallas County. And Lester W. Tyra and others versus the City of Houston and others from Harris County. In the first clause, we have allotted 20 minutes for each side for oral argument. In the second clause, we have allotted 15 minutes for each side to present oral argument. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of these two arguments. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. Counsel, or anyone who desires to listen to tapes of these arguments, may make application with our clerk. Justice Doggett is recused and will not participate in the consideration of the first clause. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Fuller versus Carpet Services.
May it please the court, my name is Luke Madole. I'm here on behalf of George A. Fuller Company of Texas, who is here with us in court by means of Wayne Sheridan. The issue before the court is one of statutory construction. The question is whether a person who pleads for interest charges interest, as the legislature used that verb in Article 5069-1.06. The cardinal rule of statutory construction is to ascertain the legislature's intent and to give effect to that intent. This case presents basically two competing meanings for the word charge, or the verb charges, as it's used in the statute. The meaning that the trial court ascribed to that statutory term was a basically placement on balance test. A creditor charges interest when he assigns interest to a debtor's account. The meaning ascribed to that phrase by the Court of Appeals, the Dallas Court of Appeals, in a 7-6 decision, was a more stringent test, a demand upon the debtor test. Not only a demand upon debtor, but a demand that is literally addressed to the debtor. And since a petition is literally addressed to the Honorable Judge of said court, the Dallas Court of Appeals determined that was not a charge. I think it's clear that the meaning ascribed by the trial court includes the meaning ascribed by the Court of Appeals, but not vice versa. There are three particular guideposts that I would urge this court to look to in ascertaining the legislative intent behind Article 5069-1.06, and they are three. The language of the 1967 enactment of that statute, the first time the word charges or the verb charge was used in our usury statutes. The state of the case law at the time Article 5069-1.06 was amended in 1979, because as the court knows, one of the rules of statutory construction is that the legislator is presumed to act with knowledge of judicial constructions of the statute. And point three, and perhaps as important as anything, is what happened in this city last week with regard to House Bill 421 over in the House of Representatives, an attempt to make a statutory amendment making pleading not a charge, which met substantial opposition and had to be withdrawn because it would have been defeated if voted upon. As to the first point, the language, I think the language is definitely more consistent with the meaning ascribed by the trial court, the placement on balance test. The phraseology used is any person who contracts for, receives, or charges interest. Now, if you take the Court of Appeals opinion, there should be in there something like to the debtor or delivers to the debtor. There's no such language. Charges is a transitive verb. The object in the statute is interest, not debtor. And so the question is, as this court said in the Windhorse versus Adcock Pipe and Supply decision, is what does the creditor do unilaterally? Not, doesn't have anything to do with the debtor. A charge is distinguished from the other aspects of usurious actions in Article 5069, that it, by the fact that it's a unilateral act of the creditor.
But that seems to lead to absurd results. A creditor could go into his closet in the dark of night place interest on a debtor's account and then take it off, and somehow he violated the usury law. Or an attorney could send a draft down to the word processor that said, charge 18% on this account. He gets it back and he looks at, oh my goodness, I should not say that. So make that back to 6%. But nevertheless, he violated the usury laws for his client. But how can that be?
Your Honor, I would say two things to that. Number one, the case we cite on page 8 of our application, the Hager versus Williams case, where the court points out that logically the debtor, without knowledge from some source of the interest charged to his account, would have no occasion to seek any recourse provided by the statute. But it does not follow that the mailing of a statement showing the interest charged and demand for its payment are prerequisites for a charge of interest within the statute.
Well, but it's easy to imagine circumstances where the attorney later said to an associate, you know, I almost made a terrible mistake. I put a demand for interest in this pleading, never sent it anywhere, but it was lying on my desk there for a long time, but I changed it. And the attorney becomes disgruntled, leaves the firm, tells somebody else, who then has occasion to sue. In other words, it doesn't seem to me to solve the problem that the debtor just doesn't know about. The debtor could find out.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, there's a case on the books we cite, the Duke versus Power Hardware and Electric Company, where they had made notations on their books of account internally, never sent anything to the debtor, and it wasn't until a deposition where the books of account are flopped out that the charge is discovered. And yes, that was held to be a charge under the placement of balance test. Your Honor, I think I'm more concerned, and I don't mean to lessen that concern, but I think the more realistic and the more likely situation reflected on the case law is an abuse if you go the other way. We point out to the Chastain case where the creditor wrote to credit bureau and said, this debtor owes us all sorts of money. He owes us a ton of interest, and it was illegal and usurious. And if you take the Court of Appeals test, that's not a charge because it wasn't addressed to the debtor. It was not a demand on the debtor. It was an statement. But I think that's a practice that definitely needs to be stopped. And I'm not saying there's no problems with the charge rule, but I think the problems with the placement on balance test, that it's a unilateral act of creditor, but I think the problems the other way are worse and definitely what the legislature intended to stop.
Maybe there's some middle ground, and that is there must be a communication of it, but to someone like a credit agency or someone who is in a position either to have to pay it or to react to the requirement that it be paid, some phrasing of a middle ground test as opposed to a request to a court who is there to protect the debtor and creditor alike. It strikes me as no more offensive to the laws of this state that someone asks for more interest in court than he's entitled to, than he asks for more damages than he's entitled to.
Your Honor, if that's true, then I guess I would say two points to that. Point one, the notion of the Court of Appeals that a petition is not directed to the debtor, is not a demand on the debtor, I think is an impractical, and only by the most sterile of reasoning can you conclude to anybody that's practiced, when you get a petition, that's directed to you. Point two, and if this court were to take that there needs to be a practical communication of that to the debtor, then I would say a pleading meets that test.
Counsel, is there not a well-established rule that pleading amendments ought to be allowed so as to avoid injustice?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, in this particular case, the pleadings were amended 10 months before the usury claim was brought. And are not those earlier pleadings a nullity at that point?
No, Your Honor, they are not. The law is clear that a superseded pleading, although it no longer functions as a judicial admission, is still usable as an evidentiary admission of a party opponent. And I would direct the court's case to two cases that show the difference between that situation and this case. One is a case not cited in our brief. It's the case of Killebrew versus Barton. I could get the cite for you momentarily. The other is the case is cited in our brief, Parr versus Tagco Industries. The difference between those two cases is there was usurious charge and superseded pleadings. In Bartlett, The creditor, the debtor, never offered the pleading into evidence. And therefore, there was at trial, there was no evidence of the charge. In Parr, the debtor did offer it, and the court specifically distinguished Killebrew versus Barclay on that ground. Your Honor, in practical point of fact, if it's done in a demand letter, if it's done in a statement of account, if it's done with an invoice, those aren't necessarily going to be in evidence unless someone puts it there. In this case, we put the offensive charging instrument in.
Counsel, why is the legislative policy served by construing a pleading as a charging of interest?
Your Honor, the legislative policies, I think, behind charging are clear. They are to deter violators, and they are it's not a compensatory measure. It's not, they're not trying to compensate anyone, but they're trying to deter violators and encourage private enforcement of litigants. In effect, they want to turn me and all the lawyers like me into policemen. And a pleading is a demand letter should be policed. Pleading should be policed. I realize there's a little problem when you start talking about legislative intent of arguing circular. If you first assume pleadings are to be deterred, then it helps the policy to deter it if you first assume they're not. But I would say this. I would say this on that. And the best example, and I hope it's not inappropriate in this court, but the best example I can come up with as to why charging ought to be, or pleadings there, or why charging is important, is biblical. As the court knows, the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, the last five have to do with what you're supposed to do. No murder, no stealing, no thieving, no coveting your neighbor's wife or ox or anything that's his. The Tenth Commandment, though, is the one about coveting. You're not to do these things. Charging is contracting for and receiving. As St. Paul pointed out, that coveting precedes murder, lying, bearing false witness, all that sort of thing. Charging bears the same sort of relationship to contracting for or receiving. It's the inner aspect of it. If you can stop and deter a charge, you'll never contract for and you'll never receive it. And I think the reason the legislature added that was added in 1967, it's not some relic from the far distant past in the Code of Hammurabi. This is something 1967, and I think they thought if we could nip this in the bud and deter it in the bud. And let me say, if this court were to tag...
I think you're going a little bit beyond.
I'm sorry.
Strict answer to Justice Corner.
Thank you, Jimmy.
I have several questions.
There are several theories pleaded in this case which would have allowed for interest as pled.
Your Honor, that is claimed in the response. I deny that is the case. If you look at Plaintiff's original petition, 3 points. They attach an Exhibit B, which is a lien affidavit, in which they clearly say that their lawsuit is based upon contract. The lien affidavit that the subcontractor filed. The invoices they attach to that position refer to a contract. The verification to that position says that their lawsuit is based upon...
Do they plead quantum merit?
Your Honor, the quantum merit claim they pleaded, they used the words quantum merit, but they said it was based on a contract. I'll direct your attention to paragraph 8. It says, pleading on the alternative, the plaintiff agreed to sell. And they talk about an agreement, and then they say in quantum merit.
Well, quantum merit is an implied contract.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, but under quantum merit, would they have been correct in asking for the interest that they did?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at paragraph 9, the last sentence, they didn't really ask for any interest in connection with their quantum merit claim. They said, in addition, plaintiff would show is entitled to prejudgment interest at the rate of 6% from and after 10 days in accordance with provisions of 50691.03, which only concerns contracts and account. So they didn't really ask any interest on their quantum merit. They asked for the contract and account claim, which were both in contract.
We know that the federal courts frowned on grounding claims on superseded pleadings. Okay. What would be the policy reason for us to adopt your viewpoint?
First, on the federal courts, Judge, they're wrong. With all deference to Patrick Higginbotham, they have ignored the eerie implications of a statute of the state. This is a substantive law question, not a procedural law question. And they have disregarded Erie in those decisions. In fact, under Swift v. Tyson, the regime which preceded Erie, this would have been state positive law that would have had to been followed. But on the policy grounds, Your Honor, the point of this whole statute is to nip things in the bud, to deter. And the policy is not to compensate Fuller. The policy is to deter charges, to deter it in any form in which it rears its head. All charging will be captured in a tangible vehicle, whether it's books of account, whether it's an invoice, whether it's a demand letter, letter to a credit bureau, or whether it's a pleading. And the whole point of this is to severely penalize it so it won't happen again, both with the individual creditor and so that the word will be disseminated to creditors as a whole. So the policy concerns are punishment and deterrence and encouragement and enforcement of a private litigant.
Using your language of punishment in Eustace Ashendore, this court explained that statutes of a penal nature should be strictly construed. If that is true, should not reasonable doubt be given to the other side?
Well, Your Honor, if there is reasonable doubt, but there, our position is there is no articulation or definition that you can make of a charge that would exclude pleading, that would not also exclude things like demand letters, statements of accounts, invoices, or placement of interest on the books. I mean, if you're going to start shoving that out the door, where do you draw the line?
Counsel, shouldn't we consider whether or not the interest is ever likely to be paid?
No.
And in the context of a judicial proceeding, the judgment that's entered in an adversary proceeding, isn't it less likely that usurious interest will ultimately be rendered as part of the judgment?
Your Honor, I, with all due respect, no, I do not think it's a proper consideration as to whether it should be paid. That is a proper consideration when you talk about receiving or contracting for interest. But the whole point of the charge, the penalization of charging, is the unilateral act of the creditor. The focus should be on the creditor, not on the effect on the debtor.
Will you give us the Killebrew site when you come back?
Yes.
How can you litigate a disputed question of law about the amount of interest you charge? If you ask for it, haven't you violated the usury law?
Your Honor, I've been aware of this problem for a long time. On the first demand letter I wrote, a partner in my law firm pulled me aside and showed me some cases because these interest questions are deemed too provincial to talk about in a national law school like I attended. And from that day to this, I had a question, especially before Perry Roofing versus Altcott, 6 or 10% in a statute or whatever. And I follow a very simple practice, and our firm follows a very simple practice. Nothing goes out without being reviewed for any request for interest, being reviewed by another partner. We never say anything except give us interest allowed by law. And if there's a dispute, I had a judgment where I gave three different judgments and said, Judge, I don't know what it is. You tell us what the law is. No. Lawyers are supposed to be aware of this law. They're supposed to follow it, and there's a right way to do it, and there's a wrong way to do it.
Well, isn't the way that you've previously done it a safe way to do it because no one understood what the right way was?
Well, partly, yes, Your Honor. But let me say, this case does not present that issue. This case does not present the question of a legitimate confusion over whether it was 10% or whether 6%. They asked for 6%, that off of the statute. They asked it during interest-free periods. That law was clear long before this case. So this case does not raise the issue of what about how do we handle uncertainty. But clearly, lawyers, if there's uncertainty, ought to handle it very carefully.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear oral argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. David Sherman, present argument.
May it please the court. I'm David Berman. I'm here for Carpet Services. I agree with Mr. Madol in that the only issue before this court now is a question of statutory construction. We are here now today to deal with one specific word in Article 5069-1.06, the word charge. What does that word mean? In terms of statutory construction, it is true that the usury statute is penal in nature. Because of that, we are obligated to strictly construe that statute. You would strictly construe it against imposing the violation. In doing so, in the event that there is any doubt as to whether or not this type of conduct should be punished, that doubt should be resolved in favor of not assessing the punishment. In addition, pleadings are to be liberally construed. Liberally construing pleadings, the reasoning behind that, the theory behind it is to promote a full and fair adjudication of the merits of the lawsuit.
Liberally construe them to the point that black equals white.
I'm sorry, Judge, I can't.
You can't liberally construe them to the point that black equals white. There was a request in these pleadings for interest on this contract, like, wasn't it, or not?
Yes, there was. There was a request.
That request was excessive.
The request asked for 6% prejudgment interest. The excessiveness, the allegations regarding whether or not it was excessive only had to do with the start date of accrual.
Right.
And nothing else.
But as to that, the request was excessive.
As to the start date, yes, it would be excessive, Judge. Assuming that it was regarded or interpreted as applying only to the contract cause of action.
So no matter how liberally you construe the pleadings, there was, with respect to the contract claim, there was an excessive request for interest.
If you liberally construe the pleadings, there is a claim for quantum merit in there. Under the quantum merit claim, interest would begin to accrue the day that the debt became due, the day that the work was done. And therefore, saying that it would start 10 days after the invoice stage and the work was done, the bulk of the work in this case was done in mid-December of 1986. The invoices were dated the following January, approximately a month later. The request for prejudgment interest requested interest 10 days after the delivery dates. The delivery dates aren't stated in the invoice, those are just invoice dates. The work was done more than a month before the start date of interest. Now, if the quantum merit claim was successful, if that was the only claim we had to fall back on, the request for prejudgment interest would not have been usurious. The trial judge even said so. Now, liberally construing the pleadings would have meant that you could construe the request for prejudgment interest as either applying to the contract cause of action or applying to the quantum merit cause of action or both. To strictly construe the pleadings would have been to only apply it, or would have been to interpret the interest request as only applying to the contract cause of action.
Why isn't the bona fide error defense sufficient?
The bona fide error defense was alleged in this case, and it was proven in this case. It was proven conclusively, but the judge, for whatever reason, decided not to apply it. The bona fide error defense only applies to mistakes with regard to facts, to errors in calculation, to clerical errors. The bona fide error defense does not apply to a good faith basis for making the allegation. There is no other defense to usury other than bona fide accident and bona fide error. If you have a mistake with regard to the law, that doesn't make any difference. If you have a mistake with regard to what you're, as an attorney, if I have a mistake with regard to the terms of an agreement between my client and the opposing party, that's not sufficient either.
If we follow your reasoning and a creditor can escape usury by amending his pleadings, why can't the same creditor escape usury by amending his demand letter?
A demand letter is different. A demand letter is done outside the context of the judicial, outside of the litigation atmosphere. A demand letter done prior to litigation sent by an attorney, that's no different between a demand letter being sent by the client itself, by a debt collector, by anybody else. There's always a possibility that when an alleged usuree receives a demand letter, that they'll just go ahead and pay it because they're afraid of getting sued. In the context of litigation, when a pleading is filed which alleges or requests a rate of interest which is usurious, there's no way in the world that creditor is going to recover that interest unless a judge reviews it and signs a judgment.
Counsel, 98% of the civil cases tried in the district courts in the state of Texas that are filed are resolved short of a jury verdict.
I understand.
In other words, most of them settle.
Yes.
You're saying there's no risk somebody will agree to usurious interest?
Well, I wouldn't assume that settlements incorporate usurious interest amounts in them. They are settled, that's true.
They're usually approved. Judgments, agreed judgments executed by a judge.
Yes.
Or non-suits or the like.
That's
right?
True. That's true. But that, I wouldn't necessarily assume that, assuming that if a usurious request is made in a petition, that the settlement would incorporate too much interest.
Can you assume the contrary, that it won't be?
I don't think that you can. I think you're right. I see your point.
Counsel, it seems to me that you're arguing that lawsuits are not in the normal course of business, or at least in the context of this case.
That's correct.
The distinction is between the charging or demanding of interest in the normal course of business, and that is what the statute is addressed at.
That's exactly right.
Pleadings and litigation. I would like to ask you one other thing. You state in your argument in the brief that the pleadings were amended and the reportedly injurious claims or interest in those pleadings were taken out, substituted pleadings, some months before the other side counterclaimed no injury. Is that
10 months
correct?
Before, yes.
So you detected your error, corrected it, and that's when they picked up on it?
Amending the pleadings, I don't know if I would have, if I would say that...
If error.
Well, yeah, I testified at the trial court level with regard to the error, and I did testify that it was a mistake, that the mistake was discovered when the amended petition was filed. And yes, it was a mistake. It should not have been phrased in that way. The magic words that were used in the original petition were sufficient for the opposing side to pick up on and enough to convince the judge that Carpet Services should recover nothing and should have to pay penalties. That was... The mistake was discovered and was amended out long before the counterclaim was made. The usury counterclaim was ever
brought. Bottom line is, whether it was a usurious claim or not, your argument is that the statute is directed at non-judicial proceedings. That is the normal course of business.
That's correct. I believe that pleadings as a matter of law should not be a vehicle for usury. Now, this court has said in Danziger versus San Jacinto Savings that the vehicle by which a charge is made is immaterial except as an evidentiary fact. I believe that that statement is wrong. I don't think that anything that you ever do can be a charge of usury. There has to be certain limitations. In terms of statutory construction, we have a list of words here. The statute says any person who charges, who contracts
for... Could you stop there for just a second? It says any, A-N-Y.
Yes. It says any person.
Any person.
That's correct.
Would not the lawyer constitute any person?
Judge, a lawyer would not, and I'll tell you why. If I sent a bill to a client of mine that owed me money, if that bill were delinquent attorney's fees incorporated a charge of interest in the absence of an agreement, if I charge too much interest as a lawyer, then I've committed usury and I should be bound to pay damages to my client for the usurious violation. However, when I'm filing a pleading on behalf of a client, the nature of the transaction is fundamentally different. I'm not asking for a categorical exemption for lawyers in general. The nature of the transaction is different. It's not the same thing. It is not a commercial transaction. It's not rooted in a free contractual relationship. It's a request for relief made to a court, subject to judicial supervision and judicial approval. One question that had been made earlier to Mr. Madol was, does it make a difference that a victim would never have to pay it? And he said, no, I disagree with that. Because this happens in judicial proceedings, you have to assume that most trial judges will apply the law correctly. You can't assume otherwise. Because this happens in the context of judicial proceedings, the possibility of there being an overcharge of interest is zero. It can't happen. Theoretically, it can't happen. There can't be any injury. Now, certainly the legislature would never have intended to create this statutory cause of action for situations where there could never be any injury, where there could never be any damage. The statute says any person. Now, what happens in, for example, in the Crane case, where in Crane versus San Jacinto, the recent case of out of San Antonio in which the Court of Appeals determined that a motion for judgment is not a usurious vehicle or cannot be a charging of interest. In that particular case, the trial judge had been presented initially with a motion for judgment and a proposed judgment. That proposed judgment incorporated a usurious rate of interest. The trial judge mistakenly signed the proposed judgment and then subsequently signed a corrected or an amended judgment which overruled the first judgment. The statute says any person. Wouldn't that judge, therefore, wouldn't the trial judge be liable for usury under those circumstances? If you apply the statute, if you interpret it broadly, broad enough to encompass any violation and any vehicle, wouldn't it not apply to not just the judge, but any sheriff or any constable who then attempted to levy execution on the judgment?
I would like to read you a short quote from the Fiber Grate, which is a federal court case in Texas, and ask you what public policy would best be served by adopting this. Construing a claim asserted only in a pleading filed in a lawsuit as an interest charge, triggering the draconian penalties of usury would do little to serve any reasonable purpose of the statute. Such a policy would exalt form over substance and run contrary to the well-established practice that pleading amendments ought to be fairly allowed to avoid injustice. Now, that's the position of the federal courts. Why should the Supreme Supreme Court of Texas adopt such a policy?
Because very simply, it's the correct policy to follow. It is the correct policy to follow. In terms of policy reasons, in terms of the legislative intent, the reason why this statute was enacted in the first place was to prevent credit abuses by unscrupulous operators, lenders, and vendors in cash and credit consumer transactions. Now, although the statute doesn't contain specific limitations as to what is a consumer, doesn't define what charging is, that was the bottom line, the underlying legislative intent, and the purpose for this statute in the first place. In terms of there being any credit abuses or unscrupulous operators, lenders, and vendors in credit transactions, not one single usury by pleading case in the state of Texas applies or has present this element of an unscrupulous operator, lender, or vendor, or any credit abuse for that matter. The usury by pleading doctrine is completely outside the realm of credit abuses. In terms of allowing pleading amendments, the reason why we can or should be allowing amendments to pleadings such that a superseded pleading will supplant a prior pleading is to promote the ends of justice. The courts that we've got today in this country, not just the state but this country, are here to resolve disputes and not create them. Now, the usury by pleading doctrine operates as the Court of Appeals in this case has said, and as I said in my brief, it's a trap for the unwary. It's a technicality which allows companies like Fuller Company to avoid the payment of a just and lawful debt. As a bottom line policy reason, payment of just and lawful debts has to be important. That's got to be a fundamental policy of this state. Now, what's happened in this particular case, Carpet Services never once added any amount to any account, never billed excessive interest in an invoice. They never did anything. No general ledger, no books of account, no journals, no nothing, no demand letters. Carpet Services never once charged any interest. The only basis of usury in this case, the sole and exclusive basis of usury, was the one allegation, the one sentence in the original petition. The phrasing of that sentence, it was magic words. Those magic words cost Carpet Services over $50,000 just because of that. And this was not a situation where unearned interest was charged, where it was a charge for unearned interest, or where it was requesting a higher rate of interest, wasn't calculating interest on a 360-day year, was nothing like that. In fact, the allegation in the petition made specific reference to the statute which authorizes recovery of interest. I asked for the correct percentage. I cited the correct statute. I just asked that it begin on the wrong day, and that was a mistake. There was a seminar that I attended last April in Dallas, and Justice Heck, you were one of the speakers there at the seminar. You had mentioned recent changes in Rule 13 and Rule 215. You had said that the reason for the changes, for these amendments, was so that the sanctions imposed would be appropriate. As an attorney, there are a number of different things that I can do that may prejudice my client, a number of different wrong things I can do that will prejudice my client. I can sue in the wrong county, and that would be a Deceptive Trade Practices Act violation. I can allege certain things in a petition that may be a violation of the Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act. Under those two statutes, though, a consumer still has to prove some type of damage. In addition to that, in this case, I could have been abusive. I could have, in conducting discovery, I could have harassed Fuller Company. I could have oppressed them. I could have done a number of different things, a whole lot of different things. All of them wrong. All of them deliberate, intentional, in violation of my ethical obligations, in violation of Rule 13, or Rule 215. But I find it, I don't believe, it wouldn't happen that no matter what I did, the sanctions imposed could not have been worse than those in this particular case. Except that, had I been abusive in discovery, probably the trial judge would have appropriately assessed sanctions against me personally, as opposed to against my client. Justice Heck, you had said at that seminar that the reason for the changes was so that a party or a litigant who files responses to discovery one day late would not be imposed a death penalty for a minor infraction. All we're talking about in this case is something worse than a death penalty for something less than a minor infraction. Merely using magic words in an original petition cost Carpet Services everything. They would have been better off. We would have been better off if the case was dismissed, if the pleadings were struck and the case dismissed.
Your argument has to be that that's what the legislature means in the statute, not that that's good policy, because we're not committed to substitute our policy views for the legislature.
No, I don't. I believe that's not what the legislature intended, Judge. In terms of the application, in terms of the use of by pleading doctrine, and the way that it applied in this case, and the way that it has applied in this state and other cases, that could not be what the legislature intended. The use of the word charging could not have meant to apply to situations that are protected through judicial scrutiny, could not have meant to apply to a non-commercial transaction situation.
Why hasn't one of the many cases who have danced around this subject said so?
The many cases that have discussed this issue haven't come out and reasoned, have not well reasoned. Those decisions don't come out and clearly discuss it. The only decisions in the state that really discuss the use of by pleading doctrine are two federal cases, the Fibergrate case and the L.D. Brinkman case. Those are both cited in my brief. Those cases discuss it in great detail. None of the Texas cases, in my opinion, none of the Texas cases really come out and say, well, this is why we have it. All they say is the only reason is it's a unilateral act by a creditor, a charge, a unilateral creditor's act, and it doesn't make any difference how you do it just so long as it's done. It doesn't make any difference how you correct it. You can't correct it once it's done. Once you ring the bell, you can't unring it. The application is unfair. The application of the usury by pleading doctrine results in manifest injustice. The result reached in this case and the result reached in cases which apply the usury by pleading doctrine results in an unfair decision, an unfair adjudication. Carpet Services was entitled to be paid its damages. Carpet Services was entitled to recover its attorney's fees, and it was entitled to recover, as a matter of right, some amount of prejudgment interest. Some amount of prejudgment interest. It was not, before this lawsuit was filed, it should not have had to pay the other side $50,000, in excess of $50,000. The only issue is the statutory construction of the word charging. In Webster's Ninth Collegiate Dictionary, there are at least eight different definitions under the verb form of the word charge. There are seven more under the noun form of the word charge. I've used the word all my life. It seems like a pretty simple word, to charge interest, to charge an account. It's not that complicated, but when you start looking into it in detail, other dictionaries have just as many definitions. It's not a simple word. When words are used in terms of statutory construction, when words in a list are used together, when you find a word in a list, you give them related meanings. To contract for or to receive interest, any person who contracts for, charges, or receives. To contract for or receive interest implies a bilateral transaction. It implies a commercial in nature bilateral transaction between a creditor and a debtor. The word charge, when applied or when used in a usury by pleading doctrine type situation, is not a bilateral transaction. It involves a court. It involves pleadings addressed and intended for a court. It involves a request for judicial relief, non-consensual relief, not rooted in a free contractual relationship. Black's Law Dictionary defines a charge differently as well. Black's Law Dictionary defines it as in commercial transactions to bill or invoice. To bill or invoice. An original petition is far from a bill or an invoice. It's not the same thing. The nature of the transaction is fundamentally different. That difference in nature means that the legislature couldn't have intended the word charge to apply in litigation. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Counsel, can a creditor charge usurious interest in their oral argument before the Supreme Court of Texas?
Could I do one housekeeping detail? Killebrew versus Barton.
Go ahead.
Before I forget it. 568 Southwest 2nd, 915, Texas Ave, Amarillo, 1978. Your Honor, there's a case that presents a question very, very close to that. It was the Missouri, Kansas, Texas versus fiberglass or vice versa, where the testimony, the first time it came up was testimony of the credit manager on the stand. And I think that excuses bona fide error if they did it in the oral argument. But in theory, yes, it should.
Why is that different from a pleading charging interest? is it?
Under the placement on balance test, I guess it would be very simple to a pleading. I'm not one that's going to go along with this motion for judgment shouldn't be a pleading or anything else. I think that when it comes to asking interest, you need to ask for the legal interest. And I'm not sure you couldn't do it in oral argument. And I don't know what the remedy would be. I mean, pleadings are said, things are set, the record is set by that time. But in theory, yes, I guess it could happen.
Is there any due process problem with taking away someone's cause of action or giving them a negative balance on their cause of action because of one remark by an attorney in a pleading, in a motion, in oral argument?
I think my first response to that would be, Your Honor, would be the underlying assumption. Of course, no constitutional issues were raised or as defense in this case. I'm not sure this case presents that in a full-blown way. But in a hypothetical decision way, of course, the charge of usurious interest would have to be brought by means of some pleading. Bona fide error would have to be introduced, and it could only be determined judicially. There's no self-help remedies or things that would implicate procedural due process in that kind of charge. I'd like to make a comment about legislative intent, since that was discussed. And I would like to point out that one of the fundamental rules of legislative intent is that the legislature is presumed to act with knowledge of judicial construction. And when these statutes were amended in 1979, on August 27 of 1979, the 5069-1.6 was amended, there were already three pleading as a charge cases on the books, the Moore versus Sabine Bank decision, the General Motors versus Uresti decision, and the Carwell Service versus Skytop decision. All three of those were decided prior to the 1979 amendments. Not only that, this court's decision in Hainer, the Houston Sachin Dorbricher's Hainer, so the interest-free period rule was already on the books at the time of those amendments. I think the fact that the statutes were amended without remedying or changing the pleading as a charge rule there is some evidence that the legislature intended pleadings to be a charge. By the time of this legislative session, five more pleading as a charge cases, in addition to the original three, had been decided. Two of those, of course, got overruled, the Rick Furniture and the Moore versus White Motor, Moore versus White Motor Credit were overruled. But as the legislature sat this session, the Nationwide Finance, English versus Nationwide Finance case, the Parr versus Tadco, and the Butler case were all on the books. And then House Bill 421 came up and hit. It was introduced by Ashby Smith of Houston. Public hearings were held on February 25, 1991. On May 14, 1991, it reached the legislative calendar and was put on the calendar. And last week, it came up for debate on the floor, the evening of May 21st. And it was called the Excuse Me for Usury Bill. It was derided as a special interest bill that encourages mistakes and unconscionable acts. And at the conclusion of the floor debate, Representative Smith tabled his own bill, which, as this court knows, at that stage in the session means he effectively killed it himself. I think that also needs to be taken in mind when this court is determining legislative intent. As you know, there was a little falderaw about argument by the Texas Association of Bank Counsel in this case. I think it's fair to say that if this court were to affirm the Court of Appeals, that they would be allowing the Texas Association of Bank Counsel to achieve in this court what it could not achieve over in the Capitol, and that is obtaining a rule that pleadings are not a charge, because that's not what the legislature intends, as I think shown by the original language, what happened in 79 and what happened just last week. I'd also like to point it out that this is, I take serious issue with the notion that courts are not commercial transactions. No, they're not commercial transactions, but they are where life and breath is given to commercial transactions. And are we to say that to collect interest, a comprehensively regulated area, that to collect interest, we're going to apply a statute to invoices, statements of accounts, and demand letters, and so forth, but when it gets down to where the rubber meets the road in a courtroom, in a courthouse, that all of a sudden that same statute is to be totally disregarded? I think that the statute was intended to govern interest collection in all its aspects, from the time it's put on the books of the company to the time it walks into a courtroom and asks for it. I would like to say a brief word also about one of the amicus briefs that are filed, because the amicus brief makes the claim that the pleading as a charge rule is a rule used by big guys against little guys. And I would say that nothing could be further from the truth. If you look just at the pleading as a charge cases themselves, they are 3-1. They're individual or consumers versus corporations. Andrew Moore versus Sabine National Bank. Alberto Uresti, he had a mobile home. Alberto Uresti, he bought a truck from, and General Motors Acceptance Corporation was on the other side. Freddie English, Boston Furniture. Nationwide Financial was on the side. Bruce Parr versus Tagco Entries, he was a farmer who was trying to build a grain silo. In this court, leaving aside the pleading as a charge rules, in this court, Joe and Judith Danziger had a home improvement loan. The side we represent represents the consumer, and the side represented by Carpet Service does not. And I wanted to make sure that the impression left on that amicus was dispelled. In fact, to show this charging rule, I put 27 cases in an appendix. 22 of those involved individuals or consumers. Only 5 of them involved disputes between businesses. I think the record is clear that this comes down on the side of the consumer. I say something also with a bit of trepidation, but I don't think it's out of place to note that 1991 finds the state of Texas much closer to the time of the Republic or the time following the Civil War, in that we no longer own our banks, and that any weakening of the anti-usury laws does not help Texans. I want to respond to the claim that the equities in this side are on the side of Carpet Services. Let me say, this is not a just debt. We had a legitimate dispute. We paid our just debts. It's undisputed at trial that we paid every other subcontractor on this job. We weren't in the business of stiffing people out of their just. We had a dispute about the time on this, to which they augmented up the ante by charging usurious interest. We didn't win the dispute in the court. The judge disagreed with us about what the contract meant. But the legislature tells us what are just and lawful debts. And debts infected by usury are not just, and they're not lawful in this state. The legislature has a plan. If you charge interest that you shouldn't have charged, you can escape that from bona fide error. And they were not even close in this case. They say they proved it conclusively. I say that if the judge had found the other way, they would have been reversed and rendered as a matter of law. The evidence was clear that the charge was made. There were no procedures in place to stop it. There was no effort. There was a total disregard of the contract. Undisputed that this whole claim was based on a contract, not quantum merit. And they totally disregarded when the money was supposed to be paid under the contract. And there is an obscure reference in their brief.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes argument in the first clause. The court will now take a brief recess.